Well, let me begin by giving you a little bit of what you can expect this Wednesday. If you've not been to one of the big Wednesdays, it's a great deal. You can come at 5:30, and for $5, they give you a great dinner, and they also includes dessert. They let you come back for seconds, even thirds. I much appreciated that when I had to speak last Wednesday. So I didn't have to speak on an empty stomach. That was nice. And at 7 o'clock, then people kind of scatter into different classes. There's 5 different classes that are operating. And really the mission, or the reason why the church is doing this, they wanted to have a teaching segment in addition to Sunday morning where they have kind of a higher level of teaching. It's kind of like a Bible college or seminary level material. And so we disperse into different classes. But Reasons to Believe is sponsoring a class on kind of the frontiers of science apologetics, although we're trying to follow it up with an introduction to apologetics later. And we have 5 speakers. Buzz has already spoken. He spoke on, making life in the lab. I spoke last Wednesday, where I kind of took you through Genesis 1 in light of the other biblical creation accounts. And really what I'm doing, the other scholars are kind of focusing on some of the latest breakthroughs on science, developing new apologetics tools, and I'm kind of giving people a biblical foundation for how you can fit in all these new scientific discoveries. So I'll be speaking again on all the flood chapters in the Bible, a lot more than just what you see in Genesis. And, people have asked me if I could try to resolve the issue of how extensive the flood of Genesis is. So I purposely titled my talk, Noah's Flood, Global or Worldwide. There is a difference. So, but Patricia Fanning will be speaking this Wednesday. And, for several years, we've had scientists spend the summer with us at their own expense to do research with our Reasons to Believe science scholar team. And thanks to a donor, we now have leased a townhouse, which enables us to have a steady stream of scholars coming in from our chapters. And what we've realized is the biggest barrier to making that happen over the years is how much it costs for California housing. So thanks to a donor, people can come and they get free housing. And Patricia Fanning is the first of our visiting scholars in this new program, now that we have a formal visiting scholar program. She's been with us a couple of months now and had agreed to come for 6 months, but has gotten so excited about what's going on, she asked if she could stay for a whole year. And I think we're going to make that happen because she's really doing some amazing research for us. Her main focus of study is looking at the current challenges within theistic evolution, evolutionary creationism, with respect to the origin of human beings, something we're going to be talking about here in the class. And she's been surveying the literature and already has developed some powerful tools showing the degree to which God must be involved in the origin of human beings. But she's going to be speaking this Wednesday on the RNA world hypothesis. That's been the favored model from a naturalistic evolutionary perspective for the origin of life. Because there are 3 main molecules that make up life. There's the DNA, there's the RNA, and then there's the proteins. And what's got people excited about RNA is they've actually found some RNA molecules that behave like proteins. And so they say it can store information, it can do machinery type operations like the proteins do. Maybe what got the origin of life started is somehow a protein molecule popped into existence, and that RNA molecule, and that RNA molecule evolved into the proteins, the DNA, and the RNA. Of course, it doesn't solve the problem of the membranes. Now, without membranes, none of this stuff will work. Anyway, that's kind of what's going on. And I've talked to you before about some of the problems with the RNA world model. She's going to give you the very latest research. And the very latest research, I've heard to give her a talk on this, is how we now recognize that life can't function unless you have a whole family of RNA molecules. Some of them are truly gigantic, with millions of Daltons. And a Dalton is simply a proton or a neutron. So you're looking at very massive molecules. And life can't function without them, but life can't function without what they call microRNA. They're tiny RNA molecules. And so without the tiny RNA molecules, life can't function. Her whole point is you need a whole suite of very distinct RNA molecules all showing up simultaneously and in the same location before you'd even have an RNA world hypothesis that's viable. And that still doesn't solve the DNA problem. Because the thing about RNA is, what's special about RNA is that it's not stable. And it's crucial that RNA not be stable. Because RNA takes information from the DNA, which is very stable, and then transfers it and has to share that information. So if it's too stable, it can't transfer and share. Kind of like these computers. I mean, they have to be able to communicate, and if it won't release the information, then it's really not going to be effective. So that's going to be her talk, and she is very good at talking to lay people. Very complicated stuff, but I know she's going to bring the cookies down the lower shelf. Should be a great talk. So, yeah.
Are you going to make her work and your lectures available in any type of recording on your website?
Well, she's working with Fuzz to develop some peer-reviewed articles that will be submitted to the scientific literature, but has already written a series, I think, of six articles for today's New Reason to Believe. By the way, if you're not getting that, I would encourage you to subscribe. There's no charge. You go to our website, and you'll see a place there called TNRTB, which stands for Today's New Reason to Believe, and you can sign up and automatically we'll send you the articles to your computer. And like 5 days a week, you get an article on some brand new scientific discovery that gives more evidence for the Christian faith. But she's written a series of six articles on the ULU segment of the human genome. And the reason why she's focused on that, that seems to be the place that the evolutionary creationist organization BioLogos is going to say that the standard biblical model, quote, needs radical adjustment. And her point is no need for that at all. In fact, the latest research, she's looked at over 100 papers that have been published in the last 9 months on that short DNA segment, and says it proves the exact opposite of what the evolutionary creationists are claiming. So anyway, those articles are already being posted, but yeah, she's going to be doing some longer pieces as well, and we're hoping by the end of her year's stay that a booklet will be forthcoming. So that's kind of the plan, but she's also a good public speaker. She's part of the Austin, Texas chapter, and so that's kind of what we're doing. Each chapter is taking one of their PhD scholars and sending him to us one at a time. The whole idea is they go back to the chapter, and they get to really provide some solid scientific support for that chapter. So we're really grateful for the donor that's making all this possible, because I think that's one way to really extend the ministry of Reasons to Believe. Yes?
Yeah, I was reading articles about this panspermia. I guess it spawned a whole new field of astrochemistry.
Well, there's actually a journal called the Journal of Cosmology that's all focused on promoting not directed panspermia, but natural panspermia. The idea that dust and rocks and comets will be delivering the ingredients of life to the Earth from distant planetary systems. But if you were here a couple of weeks ago, we basically demolished the idea of natural panspermia. And this was acknowledged even a decade ago, which is why people have been now seriously promoting the idea of a directed panspermia.
Do they have any doubt that within the next few years they'll create it in the lab?
Create life in the lab? Well, that's what Fuzz spoke about 2 weeks ago on Big Wednesday. about the progress that Venter's lab in particular is having on making life in the lab. Now, he's quick to point out this is not life from scratch. What they're doing is they're taking pieces out of existing life forms and re-engineering them and putting them together in distinct ways. And so it's basically human-engineered life. And his point is this has some ethical issues we need to be careful about, but also has the promise of considerable scientific advance. Maybe we could develop a bacterium that could take care of the radiation problems we're having in Japan and elsewhere. We already know that bacteria exist naturally that eat radioactive materials, but maybe we can get them eating it more efficiently. Greg Venter is also an idea, trying to re-engineer bacteria to make petroleum. And so get them to feed in such a way that their byproduct is petroleum. And maybe we can get some serious economic advances. But Fuzz's point is this in writing the book. Look at the technology, look at the brain power, the education, and the money that went into making these tiny steps in re-engineering life. And certainly that testifies we need somebody a whole lot smarter than Craig Venter's scientists that are a whole lot better funded to explain where life came from in the first place. So he's making an argument by analogy. A lot of Christians have been very critical of Craig Venter, saying, well, you haven't really proved anything. Fuzz is saying, yeah, they really have proved something significant. However, by analogy, it tells us that the creator of life has to be the God of the Bible. It can't be any other option, because look at how much it took just to make the steps that they did.
They're doing a lot of research. A lot of scientists right now are really working on that. So I think within the next few years, I think we're going to see something.
No, we agree. We agree that there's going to be amazing advances here. But these are not advances that in any way help the origin of life naturalistic research community. In fact, that's the very opposite. Makes their position even more difficult given what it takes to make all this happen. Life in the lab is irrelevant to what's happening, because if you're trying to support a naturalistic model, there's no intelligence, there's no financing, there's no engineering, and there's no high-tech lab. Conditions are different. They're much more challenging than what exists today. So the bottom line is we really do need an alien to explain where the life came from, but not someone from an extrasolar planet. Yeah, and I want to get to the content. Go ahead.
I always use the analogy of a hot rod or putting an old rear axle in a 32 Ford and a 327 Chevy in that same Ford. He started off with the Chevy engine and the old axle and the 32 Ford, and the guy did assemble the stuff in a new way. It takes a lot of work to do that.
Well,
and it sure don't do it by itself.
It doesn't. My wife's uncle does that as a hobby. He's got a 12-car garage in his backyard, and he buys these vehicles that are in terrible shape from the 1920s and 1930s and basically re-engineers them. But, it's quite something to get into some 1923 vehicle, very lightweight with a 400-horsepower engine in it. It really goes. Yeah.
Directing his efforts at is that, and I've read some of his book, and what he describes there, the way I understand it anyway, is that, that they do take, in the laboratory, they are taking species or molecular segments anyway that don't have life, and yet when they do combine them, after combination, they seem to have some characteristics that imitate life. So the interesting thing there is, it seems to me, is that you're going from a non-life thing to something that shows characteristics of life. And that is,
Fuzz has talked to us about that and says that some of these efforts really are in the category of artificial viruses as opposed to artificial bacteria. And there's a big debate within the origin of life community are viruses alive, or are they simply inert little machines? And then you've got what are called the parasitic bacteria, bacteria that can't live unless they have the support of bacteria that are self-sustaining. So there's actually a gradation. A recent article of astrobiology was devoted, the entire issue, to trying to define what life is and what life isn't. And, 11 articles in the journal, and at the end of it, they're saying, we can't define life. And the reason why it's so difficult to define life is because we see this gradation from viruses all the way up to these parasitic bacteria to life that can actually stand alone. And, just exactly where life begins is very difficult to pin down. From Craig Venter's position, he says it doesn't matter. Their whole focus is just taking these machines and factories that exist in these different simple entities and re-engineering them to get some kind of beneficial product that they can sell. After all, it's a for-profit company. And so if they can re-engineer a virus, they're happy with that. If they can re-engineer a bacterium and get something useful out of it, that's fine, or a parasitic bacterium. So they're not worried about whether it's alive or dead. Their whole idea is, what kind of economic payoff can we get? But there is a larger question. What is it that makes something go from non-living to living? And, that's something that Fuzz briefly addressed in the book. But he'll be the first to admit we still can't answer that. The fact that we can't answer that in itself is an argument that God's got to be behind us. I mean, look at how much advances we've been studying life for millennia. And the fact that we still can't even define it tells us something about the one that must be behind it all. Okay, in the back.
Yeah, Craig Vader was been interviewed by 6 minutes. And as he was explaining to the 6 minute guy how beautiful this DNA is, how intricate, how marvelous and all that, 6 minutes just, well, you've even got to know. This is what we know.
Yeah, no, Craig Venter is a publicly avowed atheist. In fact, the irony is that Craig Venter and the guy who's heading up NIH now, Francis Collins. Francis Collins, the Christian, Craig Venter, the atheist, actually worked together on the Human Genome Project. They got along because they basically said, we both believe that there's outcomes here that we can use. And even though we're polar theological extremes, and basically where Craig Venter's coming from, instead of giving God the credit, they say, look how wonderful nature is. It's kind of what you see in Romans chapter 1. People transfer their worship of God to the Creator. Instead of worshiping the Creator, they worship the creation. Isn't it amazing what nature did all by herself? So, yes, Dave.
A lot of people here didn't hear Fuzz's talk. Would it be correct to put it in a short sentence? Because they obviously, what he was talking about, what Fuzz is talking about in his book and speech, was obviously the scientists have made DNA or taken pieces of DNA. But when they get done with that DNA, they have to put it into an already functioning cell that has all the cell membranes you're talking about, all the mitochondria, all the factory that makes the cell. Where they got to put it back into the whole thing that's already there in nature.
Correct. Yeah, we're nowhere near the place where we can actually assemble all the components of the cell, turn the switch, and make it live. I mean, that's not happening. You're correct. What they're doing is they're taking DNA, re-engineering it, and then sticking it into something where they take the DNA out and replace it. So it's DNA replacement is really what's going on. Kind of a Jurassic Park kind of thing, right? And actually where there's been some concern raised by ethicists, saying, hey, this is Jurassic Park, and all it takes is one mistake, and we got a nasty bacterium out there that could wipe out all of the human population. And Craig Venter, to his credit, has been trying to reassure the human society, look, we're taking great care here, but then people have been very quick to say, well, there's been other laboratories in the past who promised that they were being very careful. And things happen. And so given how much risk there is a need for real caution. because, you know, in one sense, we're playing God. And so if you're going to do that, you better be careful about analyzing the outcomes of what you produce. Over here. Yeah, there's some fundamental definitions of life that everybody agrees on, that it has to be able to metabolize food from its environment or produce food. Keep in mind that even the plants that produce food by photosynthesis also have to have the capability to metabolize. But if nobody is making food, then nobody gets to eat. So one of the fundamental requirements for life is there must be life out there that's actually taking carbon dioxide and water and converting it into sugars, starches, and fats. Somebody's got to be doing that. But even those creatures have to be able to metabolize food. And then they have to be able to reproduce. They have to be able to move around in their environment or move products from their environment. So there's a mobility question. And I left one more out, but maybe somebody could help me with the one that I left out. I'm just trying to draw this off the top of my head. But there is this journal in astrobiology where they literally filled the entire journal and at the end of it said, well, we have these competing definitions for life, but we can't tell which one's right. We know what life needs. But the big question is, if you can put all the molecules in place, have them all situated just right, but you know, what is it that makes it live as opposed to just sitting there? You can use the analogy of an automobile. You get an automobile in the garage, but if nobody gets in there and puts the key in the ignition and turns it, it doesn't go anywhere. Moreover, you really need somebody directing it. I mean, who is it that's directing this set of machinery, this factory, and causing it to go? Those are the real issues that are making it so challenging to define what life is. Hey, let me actually get to where I plan to go this morning. Because we finished last week talking about the origin of the simplest life, the origin of life that's purely physical. Mentioning before, there's three different kinds of life that God creates. Life that's purely physical, life that's both physical and soulish, and one species only, that's body, soul, and spirit. And talked about how at different origin of life research conferences, and you'll see this in the Journal of Origin of Life in the Biosphere, that there's a growing consensus that from a naturalistic perspective, that is, without invoking God, you can't make the origin of life work on the surface of the earth. Therefore, maybe it came from one of the planets. But over the course of about a decade, they've ruled out Mars, they've ruled out the moons of Jupiter, they've ruled out Titan. The solar system is now off the list. And therefore, they've been talking about maybe some distant planetary system, and how life got transported from that distant planetary system. It's making it more difficult to appeal to a distant planetary system because we've yet to find a single star or planet within our galaxy that would have the necessary conditions to make life possible. So we have no candidate stars or planetary systems where life is even conceivably possible. But people have waved their hands and say, maybe we haven't looked everywhere we should look. Let's just assume it's there. Could it get from there to here? Well, it has to cross a lot of interstellar space because anything close, we've ruled out everything within about 150 light years. So it's going to have to travel more than 150 light years, which means you're looking at millions of years for the dust or the rocks to cross interstellar space, embedded within it, a bacterium or the building blocks of life. As we described, those millions of years mean you're going to be exposed to a lot of radiation. And moreover, these molecules have a short half-life. Some of them last only hours. Some last a few years. But if you're talking millions of years, none of them are going to make it. Which I mentioned last week that this is what motivated at one Origin of Life research conference that Fuzz and I attended, a scientist coming to the microphone and saying, we've eliminated everything except directed panspermia, which means aliens came in spaceships and they purposely planted life here on planet Earth. But as I mentioned, you have the question, where did the aliens come from? And here we're not just talking simple physical life. In order for them to come in spaceships, they have to have technology that's at least equivalent to ours. So we're talking advanced life, not just simple life. And then how are they going to get across interstellar space? And you can read a book we have over there that three of us wrote, Lights in the Sky, Little Green Men, which points out that if you're looking at 150 light years plus, it doesn't matter what kind of technology you have, doesn't matter how wealthy you are, the laws of physics will not allow you to move from that location to here. Read the book and it'll certainly spoil your enjoyment for Star Trek and Star Wars. All right. But as we mentioned, what really then is left? Well, this is something that's picked up by the Santa Fe Institute. That's a science institute of atheist scientists trying to solve problems like, you know, how do you explain the origin of life? How do you explain life evolving from simple life forms to human beings? And it was Stuart Kaufman who first proposed that there's a fourth law of thermodynamics. And this is a fourth law that spontaneously causes regions of the universe that are simple to become complex, regions that are disordered to become ordered. He called it the fourth law of thermodynamics because it does the opposite of the second law of thermodynamics. And his whole argument is that even in the context of the second law, there remains a possibility that you could have small isolated regions of space where you get significant departures from thermodynamic equilibrium. However, there's a big problem. It is true that thermodynamics will allow a region of space to depart from thermodynamic equilibrium with one very big proviso. It must return to thermodynamic equilibrium, and the return time depends inversely on how far away you go from thermodynamic equilibrium. So if you want to go far enough away to, say, make an RNA molecule, the snapback time is less than a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second, which means you don't get to keep the RNA molecule. You don't get to keep the life. But as I mentioned last week, the real critique of this is for life to even be possible in the universe must be extremely uniform and homogeneous. If it's not extremely uniform and homogeneous, you'll not get the stars and planets showing up at the right time in cosmic history to make life possible. So the universe itself testifies there is no such hidden law. And so Fuzz and I, on the other hand, were encouraged by the scientist saying he's on the right track. It is an alien. It is an intelligent alien with very advanced technology, but it's an alien from beyond the universe, not from one within the universe, subject to the laws of physics. As it says in Genesis 1:2, it was the Spirit of God that was hovering over the waters that brought about the first life here on planet Earth. Anyway, you can read all about it in our book, Origins of Life. And that was going to be a segue into our talk on the origin of a spiritual life. But a question came up last week as we were winding down. You know, the most exciting things happen after the whole class is over and people start milling around, we start debating things. One of the questions that was posed is, you made a comment last week that you can't get intelligent life existing until the universe is 13.7 billion years old. Now, this is important because the origin of life here on planet Earth was 3.83 billion years ago. And it's impossible for intelligent life to exist until the universe is 13.7 billion years old, then that clearly rules out directed panspermia. It would be impossible for aliens to bring life here 3.8 billion years ago, because that's far too early in cosmic history for advanced life. You can get simple life 3.8 billion years ago, but you can't get advanced life. Well, what that brought about is a discussion. Can you please tell us why? Well, today I'm going to tell you why. Why it is that we can't have human beings or the functional equivalent any earlier than 14 or 13.7 billion years after the cosmic creation event. And this is what's called the anthropic principle inequality. The anthropic principle says that when we look at the universe, we see that it's been pre-programmed, pre-designed to make life possible, and in particular, human life possible. As Freeman Dyson, an agnostic atheist physicist, wrote in his book many years ago called Disturbing the Universe, he says, when you look at the universe, you can't avoid the conclusion that somehow the universe knew we were coming. It was programmed in advance for the entry of human beings. But as we look at the laws of physics that the Creator chose for the universe, what we recognize is it's not possible to bring human beings or intelligent life upon the cosmic scene in anything less than 14 billion years. Some have speculated maybe you could wait longer, but you can't make it happen any earlier. And the inequality is that those same laws of physics will not allow civilization, you know, technology, to exist for any longer than 41,000 years. And that's the inequality. There's a factor of a million difference between these two numbers. You need a million times more time to prepare a home for humanity than the maximum time we can live in a civilized state. So what I want to do in these next few minutes, I'm going to hold off on questions a minute. I mentioned to the class on Wednesday that I was going to do it different. I was going to lecture, then questions, not take interruptions. This class, we take interruptions. I'll take interruptions in just a few minutes. But let me just give you a little bit of a feel for why this exists. And we could turn down some of the lights, and you'll be able to see some of the graphs that I'm going to be showing you here. First, why does it take so long? And I think I've shown you this before, is that in order for advanced life to be possible, you need a planet with oceans and continents on its surface. We're finding lots of planets with water, but we're not finding any planets other than the Earth that has both water and continents on its surface. And to make that possible, the planet must be super enriched in uranium and thorium. You say, why uranium and thorium? It's uranium, the radioactive decay of uranium and thorium, that provides the power, the energy source, that drives plate tectonic activity. And without that power source, we wouldn't have plate tectonics. Without plate tectonics, you're never going to get continents. As it says in Genesis 1, in the beginning of planet Earth, water covered the whole surface. There were no continents. But God had designed the Earth in such a way that continents appeared on creation day 3. They appeared because our planet is super enriched with uranium and thorium. I think I've shared with you before in the class that compared to other Earth-like planets that we're discovering elsewhere in our galaxy, our planet has 16,000 times more uranium than these other planets and 23,000 times as much thorium. I'm not going to go into all the details of why we have so much uranium and thorium, except to present this. Uranium and thorium come from one source only. And that source is supernova eruptions. Here's a supernova here. This is a spiral galaxy. And a star in that spiral galaxy had a supernova eruption. And what you notice is, for a short period of time, that star shines just as brightly as the entire galaxy. Well, it's these supernova that make all the uranium and thorium in the universe. There's no other source of uranium and thorium except these supernova eruptions. And so we now know that the solar system, for example, must have formed in the very close vicinity of three different kinds of supernova. Say, why three different kinds? Each kind makes a different suite of heavy elements, but they all make uranium and thorium. Now, as this curve shows, when the universe is young, it's aggressively producing stars. And because it's aggressively producing stars, the quantity of uranium and thorium increases. But there reaches a time as the universe continues to expand. I mean, two things are happening. When the universe expands, the gas is being dispersed. So that makes it more difficult for stars to form. And as the universe gets older, more and more of the gas of the universe is already consumed in star formation. which means after a period of time, star formation begins to run down. In fact, today, star formation is happening in only 10% of the galaxies in the universe. It has shut down at 90%. And even in our galaxy that's still producing stars, it's not producing stars at anywhere near the rate that it was, say, 10 billion years ago. So star formation subsides, and that causes the quantity of uranium and thorium to go down, because uranium and thorium are radiometric, and so it decays. Uranium, 4.5 billion year half-life, thorium, 14 billion year half-life. So it takes, the decay is slow, but over billions of years it becomes quite significant. And what I want you to notice here is when uranium and thorium hit the peak abundance. It hit that peak abundance when the universe was slightly more than 9 billion years old. So if you take that 13.7, subtract off the 9.2, that means about 4.5 billion years ago, uranium and thorium were at a peak abundance, and that's the best date we have for the age of the solar system, 4.5 billion years ago. So there's a reason why our solar system forms when the universe is, say, 9.2 billion years old. It's at that point that you get the most uranium and thorium existing in interstellar space. And as I've described before in the class, there are events in the history of the Earth that allowed it to gain extra doses of uranium and thorium. When I say that Earth has 16,000 times as much uranium as Earth-like planets we're finding elsewhere in the solar system, I'm also saying that we have far more than the rest of the solar system planets. Venus, for example, does not have anywhere near the uranium and thorium that the Earth has. It's because of the moon-forming event and the late heavy bombardment that we wound up being the uranium-thorium champion in the solar system by a wide margin, and by a very wide margin, the uranium and thorium champion of our Milky Way galaxy. Excuse me. Now, there are other reasons why you don't want to have human life existing right at the very beginning, because people can say that, well, you know, if it's at the peak of uranium and thorium 4.5 billion years ago, why doesn't God just make humans earlier? Well, here are several reasons why you want to wait those extra 4.5 billion years. One of them has to do with the luminosity of the sun. When the sun is young, it's accreting matter. And as it accretes matter, it gets brighter. The brightness of a star goes up with the fourth power of its mass. So when it's gaining mass, it gets brighter. But after it gains its mass, it starts to lose a lot of mass. The sun has lost about 6% of the mass with which it was born, which means it causes the sun to get cooler or less bright, dimmer. And then it begins to convert hydrogen into helium in its core, and that makes the core denser, and a denser core makes the sun burn more efficiently. Excuse me. So this is what the luminosity curve for the sun looks like over the history of the sun. And my point here is there's a particular luminosity that's critical for human life. Bacteria can handle a colder Earth. Human beings cannot. And you don't want to be up in here. I mean, here's another place where we have that ideal luminosity for human existence. But notice that the luminosity is changing rapidly. You don't want to be there. You don't want to be there for a lot of reasons. But that's one reason. So you want to wait till it comes back up again. And that comes up at slightly more than 4.5 billion years. And as I've already mentioned, you need time for the uranium and thorium to convert the basalts at the bottom of the ocean floor into silicates and to have them accumulate to a sufficient degree that they float high enough above the basalts that you get the continents. So it takes time for the continents to grow. And thanks to some research done about 2 years ago, we now have a detailed determination of how the continents grew with respect to time. In fact, I shared this curve on Wednesday, making the point that the Bible puts the continental landmass growth on the beginning of creation, day 3, The 6 days of creation outline the history of the earth. And if you take this curve and go back, well, the beginning of day three is where you got the most aggressive growth of the continental land masses. So this vindicates what Genesis 1 has always taught about the placement of the most aggressive period of continental land growth. But the point here is that if you're talking simple life, you can tolerate a planet where only 10% of the surface area is covered with land mass. But if you're talking advanced life, you want 29%. In fact, conditions would be much more unpleasant for us human beings if it was 28% or 30%. 29 is really the best number for human civilization, which is exactly where we are now. And what's going to happen in the future? The continents will continue to grow. So the continents will continue to take up more and more of the surface of the Earth. But as you can see, it's increasing at quite a slow rate right now. We happen to be in that period where plate tectonic activity is not as aggressive as it was here, here, and particularly here. You don't want it to be that aggressive because then you'd be having magnitude 9s every couple of weeks, and that would be devastating to the national budgets of the nations of the world, as we discovered and what happened there in Japan. So, but that takes an extra 4.5 billion years to make it happen. And if you're talking advanced life, one of the things that makes advanced life possible are large body sizes capable of a lot of activity for a long period of time. You know, what makes human civilization possible, we live 70, 80, 90 years. And because we live so long, we can actually enjoy the fruits of our labor, and moreover, we can pass on knowledge and technology to the next generation. That wouldn't happen if we only lived 20 years. The longer people live, the greater the rate of technological advance. One reason why technology is advancing so fast today is that our brilliant engineers and scientists actually live a whole lot longer than they did even 100 years ago. And so their productivity can be capitalized upon. So you want to be able to live a long time. You want to be a few feet tall, because if you're a few feet tall, you can manipulate material from the environment. And you want to be active throughout that time. I've mentioned before in the class that if you compare human beings to all other life forms, we get the greatest number of heartbeats. Our hearts beat about 3 or 4 times more than any other species on the planet. So we're able to sustain a lot of activity for a long period of time with significant body mass. I mean, that's the miracle of human beings. We have big bodies, we live for decades, and we can live for decades at a high level of activity. But that's only possible because we live in a planet that has 21% oxygen in its atmosphere. And that oxygen takes a long time to build up. In fact, oxygen is being recognized by astrobiologists as a signature for life. If you don't find a planet that's got loads of oxygen in its environment, you know that's a planet that doesn't have life on it. And particularly for advanced life, you need a whole lot of oxygen. And the downer there for the astrobiological community is you need life for a long time to build up oxygen because oxygen oxidates things. And the problem with planets, rocky planets in particular, they have a lot of stuff to consume oxygen. And so we live on a rusty rock, in one sense. And it took billions of years to fill up all the oxygen sinks in the surface and the interior of the Earth. And, you know, this is interesting because you can take the photosynthetic life on the Earth, and without the oxygen sinks, you can build up that 20% oxygen in literally just a few million years. But it takes billions of years because it's necessary to feed oxygen into all the great sinks of the planet. All the minerals on the crust of the Earth and in the mantle of the Earth have to be filled first before oxygen builds up. But just like with this growth of continental land masses, scientists now, and this again is new, for the first time have been able to accurately determine the rate of the growth of oxygen in the Earth's atmosphere. And this is what it looks like. Now, until it hits the 10% level, it's not possible to have a Cambrian explosion. The Cambrian explosion is where, for the first time, you get animals that are, say, 6 inches to a foot in diameter. Before that, everything is smaller than a centimeter, typically much smaller. But when you hit the 10% level, that's possible, but you're not going to have birds and mammals and human beings until the oxygen level gets up to the 15% level, and 21% is what's ideal for launching global high-technology civilization. And notice just how much time it took us to get there. So, and you say, is it going to continue to go up? Well, no, right now it seems to be stable. I mean, I had to kind of squeeze 4.5 billion years into that curve. But the truth is, it looks like for the last 100 million years, it's been hovering around the 21% level. Sometimes it drops down to 20, sometimes it gets to 22, but hovering around the 21% level. Now, what's interesting about the life here building up oxygen, as life builds up oxygen into the Earth's atmosphere, at the same time that life is laying down biodeposits. But the greatest biodeposit growth is going to occur when oxygen is high. You don't get many biodeposits here except lots of limestone. You do get plenty of limestone in here, but in terms of the coal, oil, and natural gas, that doesn't happen until you hit the Cambrian explosion event. And it takes time for the dead Cambrian animals to be converted into petroleum. And so in this next graph, I don't think I've ever shown this before, is a calculation of the growth of mineable petroleum with respect to time. And I got everything relative to the present year. So this is where we are today, going back in the past, Cambrian explosion, 543 million years ago, and going out to the next 600 million years in the future. In terms of recoverable petroleum, what I mean by that is petroleum you could recover by drilling wells, as opposed to just taking a bunch of shale from Colorado and Wyoming and using high technology to pull the oil out. And a number of petroleum geologists over the years have made the point, yes, it's great we have these shales and these tar sands, but let's face it, without the easily recoverable oil, the stuff you can get through drilling wells, you would never get the technology to exploit the oil that exists in the shales and that does the tar sands. And it looks like this in terms of the growth of petroleum deposits with respect to time. You say, why does it decline? I mean, this is a curve where we're not mining anything. This is the abundance you'd expect if petroleum was never exploited. It's going to build up to a peak and then drop. Now, what causes it to drop are two things. You've got the geology of the Earth that will break up and crack the domes under which oil collects. I mean, that's basically how people drill for oil. They look for places where there's some kind of natural dome where oil collects underneath it. And they just drill through the dome and, you know, suck the oil out. But if you get a big earthquake or, you know, a volcano, other tectonic events, it could crack the dome and the oil leaks out and dissipates into the tars and the sands and now becomes difficult to recover. The other factor is bacteria eat petroleum. And when bacteria feed on petroleum, they convert the petroleum into natural gas. Why do we have natural gas? Natural gas is basically bacterially converted petroleum, which means that the longer you wait, the more the petroleum gets converted into natural gas. So down here, we still have the biodeposits, but what you're getting is biodeposits where it's 99% natural gas and 1% petroleum. Whereas what's typical today is you'll find, say, 50-50 of natural gas and petroleum. And so you get to mine both. But in the future, you'd be looking at just natural gas, not the petroleum. Not that we can't use the natural gas for fuel, but it's the petroleum that really has launched our plastics industry, and that's critical for advanced civilization. And then finally, you're going to want to wait 4.5 billion years because stars are like people. They're unstable when they're young. They're unstable when they're old. They're maximally stable when they're middle-aged. And so we're now moving into solar maximum, when the flaring activity will get more intense than it is at solar minimum. But this is what it looks like for the sun over its history. One reason why you don't want to put life on planet Earth when the star is very young and at the appropriate luminosity, that's also a time when the sun is pumping out very nasty flares and X-ray and short ultraviolet wave radiation. And if you're a bacterium, you can handle some flaring. You can handle some short ultraviolet radiation. But if you're an advanced life form, you really can't. You want to be in a place where it's at the minimum. And then if you go on to the future, the sun will again become unstable. By the way, this is the way it is for all stars. What's different about the sun is it has the best possible mass. Stars that are more massive than the sun are more unstable. Stars that are less massive than the sun are also more unstable. Excuse me, I went for a run this morning and my asthma has been kicking up. So just bear with me here. But yeah, stars bigger or smaller than the sun will be much more unstable. So the sun's got the best possible mass. The flaring minimum occurs when it's 4.57 billion years old. And if I could go back to the slide, let me see if I can pull it back here. Yeah, here we go. What astronomers have discovered, about 5 years ago, is they were measuring neutrinos coming out of the sun, and they discovered that, based on those neutrino studies, the sun entered an exceptionally stable luminosity phase. And what they mean by that is where the solar cycle wasn't as dramatic as it normally is. Have you all heard of the solar cycle? Every 11 years, the sun goes through a sunspot cycle. And so we're now approaching solar maximum, which means if you look at the sun through a pair of binoculars, by the way, here's what you want to do. If you get a pair of binoculars, don't look through the sun, a pair of binoculars at the sun. You don't want to do that. Some people have put a welding glass in front of it. Put it in front of the objective. Don't put it in front of the eyepiece. It'll crack the eyepiece and burn your eyes up. You don't want to do that. The best thing to do is take your pair of binoculars, focus it on the sun. You might need a tripod for it so you can adjust it a little bit. And then you're going to kind of do the same thing as this thing does. You're going to project the image of the sun on a piece of cardboard or a piece of paper. Now you can look at the sun safely, project it out to, say, maybe a 10-inch diameter, and you'll see lots of spots because we're coming into solar maximum. At solar minimum, if you do that with a pair of binoculars, you won't see any spots. There's spots there, but they're so tiny and so few, it takes a large telescope to see them. But every 11 years, we go through that cycle. And what astronomers discovered looking at these neutrinos is if you go back 50,000 years ago, the solar cycle was more dramatic than it is today, which means that you are getting a much bigger difference between minimum and maximum. And I've got a paper here that was published in the latest issue of Astrobiology just a few days ago, and it's titled Sunspot Dynamics Are Reflected in Human Physiology and Pathophysiology. And by the way, I think it'd be a good idea not only to subscribe to Today's New Reason to Believe, we have another feature called Science Newsflash, where we try to jump on scientific discoveries right away, not with an article, but with an audio podcast. And I did one this past Thursday on this paper published in Astrobiology. And what these seven researchers did is they took a sample of data from Holland. And you say, why did they pick on Holland? Because Holland has a law where women have to take regular cervical examinations. And they've been doing this for about a 22, 23-year period. And so they have a database of more than a million adult Dutch women, where they get these cervical tests done, literally. I think maybe even twice a year they do it. I forget how often they do it. But in that data are six cervical diseases, including certain kinds of cancer. And so they're able to look at that database, and what they found, much to their surprise, is it correlates with a solar cycle. In other words, when you're at solar maximum, all six of these cervical diseases go up. And at solar minimum, they go down. Now, for your ladies in the audience, I don't want you to get disturbed, okay? We're not talking about, you know, because we're hitting into solar maximum in the year 2012. And yes, you will see cervical cancer rates go up, but they go up slightly. They don't go up dramatically. But it is interesting that all six cervical diseases were highly correlated with the solar cycle. All six of them went up. Now, for you men in the audience, the Dutch did not have, you know, I thought, well, maybe they got some kind of mandatory prostate cancer law, but it turns out they don't. But what they did to kind of figure out what was going on the male side, they found a medical researcher at the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota. And they thought, well, this is good because Minnesota and Holland are roughly at the same latitude. And the thing here is this is going to be more pronounced as you go north. Because as you go north, there's going to be a seasonal effect that you can take advantage of. But they found this medical researcher who for 42 years now has been sampling six body health indicators five times a day. Now, that takes a lot of discipline. Five times a day for 42 years straight without missing a single day, he's been measuring his blood pressure, you know, both the high and the low end of the blood pressure, his blood temperature, his respiration rate, his pulse rate, and he was also measuring his lung capacity, doing that five times a day for 42 years. And so they looked at that data, and to their surprise, they discovered that, too, was correlated with the solar maximum. Namely, at solar maximum, the male heart rate goes up, relative to solar minimum, your blood pressure goes up, your respiration rate goes up, your lung capacity goes down, your blood temperature goes up. Well, they look for daily cycles, they look for monthly cycles, you know, particularly with the women, they couldn't find any significant correlation. The only thing that stood out was the solar cycle. Now, the reason why I'm telling you this is because astroparticle physicists about 5 years ago discovered that these neutrinos coming out of the sun had the characteristics that are the signature of the sun entering a very low level of a solar cycle beginning 50,000 years ago. The same data tells us that can't last for another 50,000 years. In other words, we're in, and they also found out this only happens when you're at the minimum for flaring. Only here can you get these very low solar cycles. The other thing we've noticed, too, is in looking at stars that have the same mass as the sun, to this date, we've yet to find a star at the same mass as the sun that has as low of a sunspot cycle as our sun does. We've got the lowest sunspot cycle of any star that we can see. Now, as I told you, if it's bigger than the sun or smaller than the sun, it's going to be much worse. But even stars at the same mass of the sun, we can't find any that have a cycle as low as a level as the sun. So next time you celebrate Thanksgiving, you might want to thank God for the fact that we are living at a time in the history of the sun and we're orbiting a star that has this extremely low sunspot cycle. And even as low as it is, we can detect health hazards that are correlated with the solar cycle. So you can imagine what it would be like if, say, our solar cycle were 10 times the amplitude that it is right now. And you don't have to go very far back in time to discover that's exactly the way it was. Only in the last 50,000 years has it been that low. And only for another 50,000 years maximum will it remain that low. So that gives you a good feel for this anthropic principle inequality. Why you need the 14 billion years to get humans here, and why we can only exist in a civilized state for a short period of time. This isn't the only piece of evidence we have, but it's one of several pieces of evidence that support what Brandon Carter concluded, 41,000 years is the maximum. By the way, if you pick up our book over there, lights in the sky, probably not lights in the sky and little green men, but why the universe is the way it is, we will document why we believe it's 20,000 years maximum. And that means you've got 9,000 years left maximum, because we've had civilization for 11,000 years. 9,000 years is all we've got left. You might want to take that into account in your investment portfolio. Don't plan any farther out in the future than 9,000 years. In the back. Well, I can't give you an exact date from when we're going to be at solar maximum. By the way, if you look at these health hazards, they all peak at about 3 to 6 months after solar maximum. That makes sense because solar maximum usually spreads out over about 18 to 24 months. So you'd expect the health hazards to be most significant after you've been in solar maximum for a period of time. That's another reason why these researchers are convinced it really is correlated to the sunspot cycle. They say, what is it in the sunspot cycle that makes life unhealthy? Well, at sunspot maximum, we get more of the UVB radiation. That's the short wavelength ultraviolet radiation. And we already have plenty of evidence that that's a health hazard. And then also, that's a time when there's a lot of flaring activity. And also, they're finding that the greatest correlation is for people who live at, say, 50 to 70 degrees north latitude. That's where you get the aurora borealis. So I grew up in Canada where we were seeing the aurora, spectacular auroral displays at every solar maximum. That also means that Canadians are probably at greater risk for these health hazards because they're getting more exposed to the solar maximum damage than, say, people who live at the equator. But again, I'm not running my Canadian relatives and telling them to move south because the health difference between solar maximum and solar minimum is something we can barely measure. It's really only in the latter part of the 20th century where we could even detect that kind of a difference. It is significant, but it's a small difference. But it's such that if we were to say what would have been like, say, 100,000 years ago, it would have been very difficult for us human beings to live as long as we do right now. You know, we are living at this ideal moment.
I'll take these last two
questions
here.
Okay. All right. Yep, go ahead.
I haven't thought this statement out fully, but okay, you're talking about our sun that developed at about 9.2 billion years into the age of the universe.
Right.
And therefore all the things associated with that in our life. I wonder if you took could you take a sun that was formed at, let's say, 3 billion, 2 billion, 5 billion years after the universe began, and then all these graphs you're showing would apply at that time. Well, what's wrong with that argument?
What's wrong with that argument? You wouldn't have the uranium and thorium you need. The sun cannot form early. If it forms any earlier than about 9 billion years after the cosmic creation event, the emerging solar nebula would be lacking uranium and thorium that's necessary to make a planet like Earth where continents are even possible. And keep in mind, Mars is the only planet in the solar system that has adequate uranium and thorium to drive plate tectonics for billions of years. And it's because we not only had our solar system form at the right time, the Earth had a special history. The moon forming event, the late heavy bombardment, which super enriched our planet in particular, uniquely, with all that uranium and thorium. Now, by the way, I want you to make sure you catch the conclusion here. This is why directed panspermia cannot be responsible for the origin of life, because there's no way you're going to get advanced life until those 14 billion years have transpired. So if you're talking about 3.8 billion years ago, the only advanced life form that could possibly have put life here on planet Earth is the one that transcends the universe, because anything in the universe would be lacking all this physics that's necessary to bring them about. Advanced life is impossible 3.8 billion years ago for anything that's subject to the laws of physics of the universe. Yes, Alan?
You were saying it's 20,000 or 40,000, the civilization lifespan.
Right.
So we're in the, then you mentioned 20,000, so we're at 10,000, we're right in the middle of it, right?
A little bit past the middle.
But I don't know, when you say civilization, I mean, do you mean humans will be extinct in 10,000 years, or we're going to blow ourselves up? I don't quite get what you mean by this. What's going to happen in 10,000 years?
Okay, what's going to happen in about 9,000 years is we'll no longer have the physical circumstances that will enable human beings to be living in villages and small cities, specializing in certain civilized activity, and trading with one another through transportation corridors. That began 11,000 years ago, you know, where village A would only make pottery, the village B would only engage in animal husbandry, village C would only grow crops, and then they would trade with one another. That's the Neolithic Revolution. That's considered the birth of human civilization. Now, that requires that people live for a period of time. It requires that they be able to harvest resources efficiently from the environment. If you're talking about humans living at a low population level where the average lifespan is 30 years, where we're not trading with one another, everything is subsistence, hunter-gathering type of activity, then yeah, you can go a lot longer than those 100,000 years or 40,000 years. But if you're talking humans at an organized, civilized state, the window, according to Carter and Barrow and Tipler, is 41,000 years maximum. According to our calculations, 20,000 years maximum. And if you're talking civilization at the level of World War II or higher, 2,000 years, maybe only 1,000 years. You cannot sustain the kind of civilization we have for longer than 2,000 years maximum. Most scientists say 1,000 is the maximum.
I still don't understand. What would make that deteriorate?
Well, you'll see this in why the universe is the way it is. There are many factors why it can't be longer than 1,000 or 2,000 years. But the two that I think are the most significant, wealth and technology drive human extinction. So the wealthier we become, the more technologically advanced we become, the faster we proceed towards total extinction of the human species. Why? Okay. The wealthier people become, the more they tend to live in cities, and the more they tend to not sleep as much as they normally do, and consequently, the fewer children they have. In fact, in the city-states of the world today, there's a catastrophic drop in the birth rate. And it's a drop in the birth rate they can't stop. Singapore is a good example. It's a city-state with high wealth, high technology. And they put in force all these incentives for women to bear children.
What city?
Singapore. So yeah, if you're a woman in Singapore and you're having children, you're going to be wealthy. I mean, they're doing everything they can to encourage women to have children. It's not working. The birth rate now is 0.55 children per adult in Singapore. And just 10 years ago, it was 0.75. It's dropped that far just in a single decade. And the Singapore authorities are saying there's nothing that can stop it from going down to zero unless somehow they go rural, drop their population, drop their wealth, drop their technology. But that's not happening. And by the way, we're seeing this in Japan. They're also experiencing a catastrophic drop in the birth rate. Hong Kong, another city-state, birth rate is plummeting. Here in America, it's going down. The reason why our population is going up is immigration. But if you take out the immigration factor and the fact that new immigrants tend to have more children than people who've been here for one or two generations, we too are looking at a desperate situation if you project out. Problem number two, if you've got high technology, then men and women put off getting married and bearing children. I got to see that in Hong Kong. In Hong Kong, you can't even get a job as a waiter or a waitress unless you've got at least a bachelor's degree. I mean, I can't figure out why you need a bachelor's degree to wait on tables, but I've been told you cannot get a job as a waiter in Hong Kong unless you have a bachelor's degree. They prefer a master's, but they will take a bachelor's. Well, I think you can see the problem here. It takes time to get a bachelor's degree, and especially with a high tuition rate. I mean, I've got two sons that are 22 and 25. They've yet to graduate. It takes because it's not as easy, given the challenges of college education, just to zip through in 4 years like we did in the old days. So that means people are putting off children. And one of the things I've been seeing in both Hong Kong, Japan, and in Singapore is I thought it was the men. I mean, we got to get our master's and PhDs. We have to get a postdoc. We got to get established in our careers. You know, I couldn't even think about marriage till I was 32. That was the earliest I could even financially consider supporting a wife. That's why I waited that long. But they're discovering it's really the women that are delaying getting married. Because what they're seeing is that young women living in cities with high technology and a lot of wealth really look at marriage as something that stilts their lifestyle. They can't spend all their money on clothes and gadgets and going out every night. Once they get married to a husband, then life changes. Didn't used to be like that, but that's what technology does for you. And the problem there is the longer people put off having children, the more deleterious mutations they pass on to the next generation. Deleterious means a mutation that's harmful for the survival of the individual species. Okay, I know I'm a little over. I went over last week. Okay. Let me just make this concluding statement here. Is that here you get a guaranteed extinction of a population if you have a deleterious mutation rate of one per individual per generation. Here in America, we're at three per person per generation. If that's true of all the technologically advanced nations of the world, and I presume that it is, then you're looking at the extinction of the human population in about 1,000 years. But there is a cure. The cure is this. Forget about your wealth and technology. Then you can alleviate that problem. But I would hate and challenge you. Do a poll of your children and see how many of them are willing to let go of their wealth and technology. Okay, with that, we'll close in prayer. Father in heaven, yes, we are heading rapidly towards extinction. We're also heading rapidly towards the fulfillment of the Great Commission, where peoples from all different ethnic groups on this planet will have heard the good news of Jesus Christ, where significant numbers, large fractions, will respond by giving their lives to Jesus Christ. And you promise us in advance that the moment that happens, you'll return here to planet Earth and bring about a new world order, a real new world order, where we'll all be in submission to you in preparation for our transfer from this creation to a brand new creation, where the physics will be different because sin and evil will never exist again. Lord, help us to work with your Holy Spirit in such a manner that we can hasten that day when we can leave this creation and enter the brand new creation, where we can enjoy fellowship with you and one another, free of sin, free of evil, free of pain, free of decay, for the rest of eternity. In Jesus' name, amen.